Welcome back. First, the week's top medical stories from Physicians First Watch from the editor, Amy Herman. And then we have a conversation with Paula Byrne, and we'll talk about the overuse of statins for primary prevention of cardiovascular events. Here's the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. A meta-analysis of 40 randomized trials finds that cannabinoids offer little to no benefit for most mental health disorders like depression and anxiety. The researchers conclude, quote, "The use of cannabinoids as treatments for mental disorders cannot be justified at this time." Next, in a new study, roughly 6% of sexually active teenage girls and young adults tested positive for oral human papillomavirus, or HPV. The good news? Females who'd received the quadrivalent HPV vaccine had an 80% lower risk for oral HPV types included in the vaccine compared with those who weren't vaccinated. Elsewhere, a large meta-analysis suggests that anti-inflammatory agents like omega-3 fatty acids and celecoxib might help treat major depressive disorder in adults. These agents seemed more efficacious when they were added to other depression treatments than when they were used alone. Next up, a report confirms that two cases of drug-resistant E. coli bacteremia in patients who received fecal microbiota transplantation capsules from a single donor did in fact result from the fecal transplants. One of the patients died. And finally, researchers report that an investigational tuberculosis vaccine maintained its efficacy several years after it was given. The vaccine or a placebo was given to HIV-negative adults in Africa who had latent TB. At 3 years, the vaccine was 50% effective at preventing active pulmonary TB. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Ilia's latest clinical conversation.
This week, our guest is Paula Byrne, whose analysis of using statins for primary prevention of cardiovascular events reminds clinicians of the need both to engage in shared decision-making with their patients and to keep a healthy skepticism about statistical confidence intervals. Dr. Byrne's essay in the BMJ sums up her graduate work, described in a footnote as, quote, "examining the boundaries of appropriate use of medicine and overuse in the context of statins in primary prevention," end quote. She is a health services researcher. This work was done while she was a Sphere Scholar at the National University of Ireland at Galway. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Byrne.
Thanks very much, Joe.
So is it fair to say that you've taken your PhD on the question of using statins for primary prevention? And if so, how did that question come to attract your interest?
Overall, I wanted to look at the issue of medicalization, how medicine has encroached in more and more areas of our life. And I wanted to find an example of somewhere that there had been a large increase in the use of a particular medicine. So statins fulfilled that criteria for me. And I wanted to look at the subject from various different angles, because I think in health research, sometimes we're guilty of just looking at things from one particular angle. And I feel that there are many pieces to the jigsaw that need to be put together on probably most questions.
So your introduction notes that statins rank at the top of the list of drugs prescribed worldwide, with an estimated market value of approaching $1 trillion. That's trillion with a T. Or $1,000 billion, which is a lot of money,
quite a bit of money, and in the context of healthcare resources that are always overstretched, I think that is an important context.
And so your essay in the BMJ was really a summation of your work in this area, and your work included three meta-analyses, I think, of other work.
Yes, so it was based largely on three published papers that we have done. The first question that we thought we needed to ask was, who is actually using statins and why are they using them? And this analysis was published in the BMJ Open last year. So we took a database in Ireland called TILDA, which is the Irish Longitudinal Study on Aging. And we found out that of this group of over 50s who are representative of community dwelling adults, they're not particularly sick people, about 30% of over 50s in total were using statins. But of that 30%, almost two-thirds fell into the primary prevention category. And we concentrated on primary prevention, which is when somebody has not had a cardiovascular event and they're taking statins to prevent the potential, a potential event in the future. So the vast majority of statin users in Ireland and in other countries, we think, are using them for primary prevention. And particularly in women, there was, of the women who were taking statins, almost three quarters were taking them for primary prevention. So obviously, if that large proportion of people are in the primary prevention category, we need to be very sure about what we're doing and why we're prescribing for that group.
I was struck by the fact that almost three quarters of the women were in the category of use for primary prevention, and just over half the men. So there's a kind of a favoring or disfavoring of women in this, depending on your point of view. And that's a kind of cultural indicator, isn't it, as to how these statins are being used?
Well, it could be. And in a fourth paper, which we haven't referenced here, but we have published in a journal called Health, Risk and Society, we looked at kind of this qualitative end of things in terms, we did a literature review of what is out there in terms of qualitative research on attitudes, opinions, behaviours of physicians and patients in terms of statins for primary prevention. Now, there is a bit of literature, certainly in the medicalisation literature, on are women more medicalised than men? It's a big, big subject, and I think I've only dipped my little toe into it, so I won't pretend to be an expert on that area at all. But it certainly raised questions for us, that difference between men and women.
And so, speaking of medicalisation, you examined the implications of the European guidelines on statin use over a period of some 30 years. And over that time, so describe what you found there.
So we identified one driver of medicalization as being changes in clinical guidelines. And we know that in general, as clinical guidelines have changed over time, they tend to expand the use of a drug or the definition of a particular diagnosis. So more and more people are captured within that category. So while there have been nice studies done in recent years on maybe the change between one clinical guideline and the next and how many, what the implications are for eligibility, we thought that it would be interesting to look at it over a long period of time. So we went right back to the beginning of statins in the 1980s, and we looked specifically at European clinical guidelines, and there have been seven iterations of those in that 30-year period. So we went back to our database of over 50s in Ireland, and we applied the criteria that would have been there in 1987, according to the clinical guidelines, and estimated the proportion of that group that would be eligible for statins. And then we did the same with each new iteration of the clinical guidelines up to 2016. So where we started in 1987, that about 8% of that group of over 50s would have been potentially eligible for statins.
8%.
At that time, 8%.
Yes.
By 2016, potentially 61% of that group would be eligible for statins. So that's quite a large increase in eligibility. Now, I have to say that this is potentially eligible. And it's important to say that, you know, people will go to their doctors and hopefully their doctors will say, well, look, you need to lose weight, you need to stop smoking, whatever it is. So we're not saying that proportion are on statins, but this is what the guidelines could allow, if you like, that eligibility.
And then what you did is you looked at the number needed to treat, to prevent a major cardiovascular event. And, yeah. And it switched from 40 in the late 1980s to 400 in 2016, yeah. which is a tenfold jump.
Yeah.
So yeah. That means that's really propelling statins towards the $1 trillion market value, isn't it?
Yes. I think there's two perspectives that I always try to keep in my head on this. One is the perspective of the individual patient and the doctor trying to prescribe for that patient. And the second is a societal resource allocation perspective. So if you think of it as an individual, and if I said to you, Joe, I want to give you a medicine for the rest of your life, is it acceptable to you that, you know, of 40 people that I give this medicine to, one will benefit? And you might say, yeah, that's, you know, okay odds, I'll take that. And then how would you feel if I said to you, I'm giving you this medicine, Joe, of 400 people that take the medicine, one will benefit? You probably would have a slightly different value on that. And then from the point of view of society and reimbursement of drugs, and as I've already said, overstretched healthcare budgets, are we really getting the bang from our buck in spending, if on low risk people in particular, could we spend that money better? You know, I always think, I have a neighbor up the road who has leg ulcers, and an elderly lady, and she can't get her leg ulcers dressed more than once a week, and she probably needs them dressed twice or three times a week. So is it fair to be reimbursing a low risk person with statins and not dressing my neighbor's leg ulcer?
Yes. So your thesis, I guess, is that according to the available data, the statins are most effective among those at highest risk. But in general, the lower the risk, the lower the benefit, right?
The lower the risk, the lower the absolute benefit. So to explain that, if I get a clinical trial that tells me there is a risk reduction in some outcome of, say, 30%, okay, which would be quite good. If I say there's a reduction in risk of major coronary events if you take statins of 30%. Now, if I'm a low risk woman, if my overall baseline risk, which should be calculated according to my gender, my weight, my age, my smoking status, my blood pressure, perhaps my total cholesterol, and there are different methods of assessing somebody's baseline risk. Supposing my risk is 3%, and you tell me taking statins is going to reduce my risk by 30%. Well, 30% of 3% is 1%. So I'm going to go from 3% to 2% risk. Now, compare that to maybe an overweight, smoking, older man who has high blood pressure, and his overall risk is 30%. And I'm reducing his risk by 30%. He's now moving from 30% to 20%, which is quite a good risk reduction, one would think. So there's a massive difference in absolute risk reduction. And I think that patients' own values have to be considered in that, because what you might consider is a good risk reduction, I might not. And I might not think it's worth taking a medicine for life to take that risk reduction. But to further complicate the matter, and just to go back, our third paper was an overview of systematic reviews. Now, what that means, a systematic review, as your listeners will probably know, is a review of clinical trials that are of high standard, and you try to bring together the data and perhaps perform a meta-analysis on it. An overview of systematic reviews is a review of reviews. No. So it's another layer up. And there's quite a few systematic reviews published on statins and on statins in primary prevention. But actually, a lot of them include a certain proportion of secondary prevention people. So again, trying to be as pure as we possibly could be in terms of looking at primary prevention, we decided to do an overview of exclusively primary prevention data. And we were surprised that actually there were only three sources we could find that were of exclusively primary prevention data. Now, when we looked at the results of this, we found that while the reported results were, you know, there were, say, five or six different outcomes reported. So, for example, all-cause mortality, vascular death, non-vascular death, etc. And while overall the results reported were what we call statistically significant, when you broke these down by baseline risk profile, you found a lot of the results were not statistically significant. And before your listeners run out of the room screaming when I mention statistical significance, I think the concept of confidence intervals is really important in this. So a trial will report a risk reduction, but a trial is a trial. It's not the real world. So confidence intervals are a range of values. We say we think that the risk reduction is, you know, say 30%, as I mentioned. But in the real world, we estimate the confidence interval as a range of values around that. So perhaps between 50% reduction and 5%. The true value is somewhere in there. That's the confidence interval. But what happened with a lot of these results we reported was that the confidence interval suggested that you would possibly have a risk reduction, but you could possibly have a risk increase. So this adds another layer of confusion to trying to decide whether or not a person should take a statin. So again, say going back to major coronary events, one of the outcomes reported. If I said to you, Joe, I'm giving you a statin, the trial said that you're going to reduce your risk of a major coronary event by, this is a real reduction that we found, by 24%. But I am telling you that in the real world, the risk reduction for you could possibly be a 50% reduction or a 17% increase in your risk of having a major coronary event. Now, what do you think about it? So this has added another layer of difficulty and another layer of physicians having to have a conversation with their patients about uncertainty and being really clear about the uncertainty in statins in primary prevention. So again, if you're a very low risk person, your absolute risk reduction is very small, even if the value that is reported in the trial is true. But you have this added layer of uncertainty that actually there might be no risk reduction at all.
And so what you're advocating for in your commentary, in your paper, is a discussion, a shared decision with patients.
Yeah. I think certainly on this side of the water, I know probably in the US as well, the debate on statins has become very polarized and, you know, can become quite divisive. And I think, again, going back to the little bit of research we did on the qualitative research, I think physicians and patients are probably, you know, sometimes confused as to how they should deal with this. And for physicians, you know, is it a given that statins should be prescribed if somebody's, you know, high risk or low risk, or if their cholesterol is above a certain level? And I think that if physicians are aware of these uncertainties and can communicate those to their patients, then it's up to the patient in terms of their own values and preferences to decide. Again, that is from the perspective of the individual patient and prescriber. From a societal perspective, I would say we need to have a conversation about what constitutes low value care and waste. And I know that you had a very nice study published in the US recently on waste in healthcare spending. And I had a look at that. And the analysis suggests that in the US, somewhere between 75 and 101 billion in spending constitutes over-treatment and low-value care, part of which is low-value medication use. Now, can we get at that waste? Is there some way that we could identify it and cut it out? So that's from the societal perspective.
So let me ask you, Dr. Byrne, what do you hope that people will do, say, next week that they weren't doing this week, having read your paper?
I think that if people are concerned about this, that they need to have a conversation with their doctor. They need to understand what their baseline risk is. Are they a low risk woman? Are they a high risk man? And it's, I'm not saying that men are always the high risk ones. And then what is the absolute risk reduction they can achieve from taking statins? And then in terms of their own values, and also considering something I suppose we haven't really touched on, is the potential for harms from statins. How will they balance those benefits and harms? And what would they decide? You know, then it needs to be a shared decision-making scenario.
And those harms are themselves controversial.
I suppose one issue is that the data on harms are not really available for independent analysis. And there have been many calls that those data would be released for independent analysis. So while the estimates from studies, say, for example, from the CTT, the Cholesterol Treatment Trialist Group, would say that if you treat 10,000 people for 5 years, you're going to get 5 cases of myopathy, you're going to get 50 to 100 new cases of diabetes and 5 to 10 cases of hemorrhagic strokes. But there's a big difference between what these studies have reported and observational studies and what people consider to be myopathy or muscle symptoms. You know, it's possible that in the real world, those are much higher. It's possible that what is defined in the trials as myopathy is too high a bar for real people and real physicians. So there is quite a bit of controversy about that. So in terms of harms, I think the big issue is the release of those data. And then, of course, you also have issues around bias in trials, what is reported, what is published in trials and what doesn't get published. And is there underreporting of harms in trials? Do the characteristics of those participating in trials reflect the real world? You know, so there are a lot of issues around trying to estimate harms from statins.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Byrne, for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
That was our 240th episode. The whole collection is searchable and available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these chats. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.